Last week we started John chapter 11, and if you remember, chapter 11 is more a transitional chapter in John's gospel. Jesus is transitioning now between his public ministry, where he's showing himself to multitudes and crowds, performing miracles, and he's transitioning to a more private ministry, where he's just going to be focusing on his disciples, teaching them, on his followers, on his true believers, just to strengthen their faith, to ground them in their faith, to give them an established, firm foundation. He's preparing his disciples for when he is going to be gone. And they need some truths to hold on to during this time. And so chapter 11 comes to the end of what is often called in John's Gospel the Book of Signs, because chapter 11 records the raising of Lazarus. It's the last of the seven signs that Jesus performs within John's Gospel. And chapter 12 begins what's called the Book of Glory, where we see the glorification of Christ, his crucifixion and his resurrection. But the primary focus that Jesus wants to instill, the primary truth that Jesus needs to instill into his disciples, is who he is. This is what their trust is going to be grounded on, is who he is, really. So many people out there just think, have their imaginary view of Jesus. They don't understand Jesus as he is, as he truly is. You know, Jehovah's Witnesses have a Jesus. The Mormons have a Jesus. The liberal church has a Jesus. So everybody has their own conception of who Jesus is. But there's only one true Jesus, and that's the Jesus of the Bible. And this is what Jesus is attempting to ground his disciples in, is who he is. The primary truth that he's instilling is who he is. And just for the sake of review, we'll go back over a little bit. We covered last week verses 1 through 16. But in verse 4, when the messenger comes to Jesus and tells him of Lazarus' sickness, what does Jesus say? This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified by it. And we saw that the term glorified there, it's not referring to praise. It's referring to the revelation of who Jesus is. John chapter 1, verse 14, we beheld his glory, the glory of the only begotten Son of God. So it's pointing to who he is. That he is the Christ. That he is equivalent and equal with God. That he is deity. So that was the primary purpose of the miracle. And the secondary purpose we saw in verse 15. I'm glad for your sakes that I was not there so that you may believe. But let us go to him. So the secondary purpose was to instill this greater faith, this greater trust in the disciples. And how did he do that? He didn't rush right off to heal Lazarus. No, we're told that he delayed 2 days longer in the place he was, verse 6. But why did he do this? Well, verse 5 says, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. When, therefore, what's the therefore? What's it referring to? Referring to Jesus' love for Mary and Martha and Lazarus. Therefore, he heard that he was sick. He stayed then 2 days longer. The delay was an expression of love, not an expression of indifference, because there was such a higher purpose that Jesus had in mind that was going to be worked out in the lives of Mary and Martha and Lazarus and the disciples. A lesson that they needed to learn. They required a true knowledge of God, a true knowledge of his will, and to understand that God's will is in harmony with his nature. This is something some people don't seem to grasp. God's will is always in harmony with his nature. And see, this is why people will attribute such a bizarre and unbiblical, even immoral actions to the will of God. I've had people tell me who are engaged in an adulterous relationship that God brought them together. This was God's will for their life. Or it was God's will that they divorce their husband or their wife to take up with somebody else. That it's God's will for us to be rich, healthy, wealthy, prosperous. That it's God's will that we have some sort of mystical experiences. Or that it's God's will that He gives us new extra-biblical revelation. Or that it's God's will that we should live sinful lives. After all, this is the way God made me, right? God made me this way. So how can it not be His will that I live this way? Or it's an excuse for a self-indulgent life. God just wants us to be happy, right? That's God's highest goal for our life, is just for us to be happy. And so they attribute their self-indulgence and their self-gratification to the will of God. And all of this is because they have no knowledge of God. They do not understand God as He is. God's actions are in harmony with His nature. And this is why we can't judge God's character, why it's very dangerous to judge God's character by our circumstances. See, this is what Jesus is trying to teach the disciples, what He's teaching Mary, Martha, Lazarus, those who are witnesses of this. We don't judge God's character by our circumstances. We judge our circumstances by God's character. This is what Jesus is teaching His disciples. It's what He wants to teach us and what we need to understand. Now, John chapter 11 can be divided up basically into four parts. You have the preparation of coming to Bethany, which is what we did last time. You have the arrival of Jesus, which we see in verses 17 through 29, which is what we're going to cover this morning. Then you have the miracle itself in verse 30 through 44. And then you have the response to that miracle in verses 45 through the end of the chapter, verse 57. But we're going to look at verses 17, the arrival of Jesus today, in verses 17 through 29. Let me go ahead and read that. So when Jesus came, He found that He had already been in the tomb 4 days. Now Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. Martha, therefore, when she heard that Jesus was coming, went to meet Him, but Mary still sat in the house. Martha therefore said to Jesus, "Lord, if You had been here, my brother would not have died. Even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you." And Jesus said to her, "Your brother shall rise again." Martha said to Him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in Me shall live even if he dies, and everyone who lives and believes in Me shall never die. Do you believe this?" She said to Him, "Yes, Lord. I have believed that You are the Christ, the Son of God, even He who comes into the world." And when she had said this, she went away and called Mary, her sister, saying secretly, "The teacher is here and is calling for you." And when she heard it, she arose quickly and was coming to Him. Well, this section, the arrival of Jesus, can really be divided into two parts. You have verses 17 through 29, where Jesus is dealing with Martha, and then verses 30 through 37, where Jesus is dealing with Mary. But here He's dealing with Martha. Now we're told in verse 17 that when Jesus arrived, He found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Now it was Jewish custom to bury a person the same day that they died. And the Jews had various names for the crypt or for the tomb in which they placed the deceased person. Alfred Eidersheim, who's written a great book called The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah, and gives great insight into Jewish custom. Jews would call the tomb the house of silence or the house of stone. They would call it the couch, the resting place, place where you spend the night. These were just different euphemisms that they had for the grave. Well, Lazarus here is not in a cemetery. He's in a private tomb, which most of the time would have been in some type of a garden. And In these tombs, if it wasn't a private tomb, a tomb would have held anywhere from 8 to 13 bodies. And they were placed in niches. The tomb was either in a cave or it was carved out of solid rock, such as the tomb Jesus was in. We were told his tomb, that was owned by Joseph of Arimathea, was carved out of rock. And it was his own private tomb. It wasn't meant for anybody else. But they would place the bodies in niches, carved niches into the side of the cave. And these niches would have been about 6 feet long, maybe 18, 20 inches tall, and about the same depth in. And they were placed in these niches, which were called kukin. Kukin was the Hebrew word for them. And again, unless they were private, they held 8 to 13 bodies. And they would have been stayed in there until they were totally decomposed, and the bones would have been gathered up and put in what was called a bone box and stored, kind of like a mausoleum, just stored in these bone boxes. And often the body would have been anointed with spices like aloes and myrtle and hyssop. We're told that when Jesus' body was anointed, when Joseph of Arimathea came to get the body of Jesus, he brought about 100 pounds worth of spices with him to wrap up with the body. And this was to help cover the smell of decomposition, as well as slow, possibly, the rate of decomposition. Now, it was the common Jewish thought that decomposition began the fourth day. See, in verse 39, when Jesus asked to have the stone removed, Martha objects and says, "By this time there will be a stench," or as the King James says, "he will stinketh," for he has been dead 4 days. Been dead 4 days. He's starting to decompose. So the Jewish thought was that this decomposition began on the fourth day, and that the soul hovered over the body for 3 days, waiting to re-enter the body. But once the body changed, once decomposition started, then the soul left permanently. And then at that point, death was irreversible. It was irreversible. So by mentioning the fact that Jesus had found Lazarus, had been in the tomb for 4 days, John is magnifying the awesomeness. He's just magnifying this miracle. It just points to the fact that is anything too hard for the Lord? No, here you got a body that's not only dead, it is decomposing dead. There's no room for doubt as to Jesus' identity when he raises Lazarus from the dead. And see, this is the faith that needs to be instilled. Paul appeals to this. In 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 8 through 10, Paul is relating just the struggles that he has been through as an apostle. It says in verse 8, "For we do not want you to be unaware, brethren, of our affliction which came to us in Asia, that we were burdened excessively beyond our strength, so that we despaired even of life. Indeed, we had the sentence of death within ourselves, in order that we should not trust in ourselves, but in God who raises the dead, who delivered us from so great a peril of death, and will deliver us, he on whom we have set our hope. And he will yet deliver us." See, if God can raise the dead, don't you think he can take care of whatever problem we have? That we can entrust that to him? There's no lack of ability here on Jesus' part to do what Mary and Martha wanted him to do, was to heal Lazarus before he died. There was no lack of willingness on his part. He just had a greater purpose. No, the only thing that's lacking here was a lack of trust. And this is what Jesus needs to instill in them. Verse 18, "Now Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off." Literally, it's 15 stadia, about 9,900 or 9,090 feet, a little less than 2 miles, about 1.7 miles off. "And many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother." See, the reason John adds how close Bethany was to Jerusalem, it's not only to point out the danger that Jesus is placing himself in, Because remember the last time he was in Jerusalem, they were trying to stone him and to kill him. And this was the objection that the disciples had of going back to Bethany. Lord, you're going to go back there? They just tried to kill you. They just tried to stone you. So he's putting himself in great jeopardy. But it's also just to point out where all these people came from that are consoling Mary and Martha. They've come from Jerusalem. It's only 1.7 miles off. Now, the Jews had some elaborate customs when it came to mourning. They would often hire professional mourners who would weep and wail and carry on and scream, beat their chests. So they had some very elaborate customs. And the mourning would go on for 30 days. But the first 3 days were the greatest periods of mourning. And so these people had come to console. Literally that word means to draw close in a friendly way. They came along to console them, put their arm around them, comfort them. And often these mourners, these people who would come to console, they would stay with the family. They'd stay in the house of mourning. So this was no drop by, bring a casserole and leave type of thing. These people stayed. Up to a week they would stay. And they wouldn't just stay with them in the house. If they left the house, they would accompany them. They would follow them everywhere. So they wouldn't be alone in their grief and in their mourning. This explains why in verse 31, when Mary goes to meet Jesus, everybody got up and went with her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. So they all got up and followed her. You didn't leave the mourning person alone. Now this, again, is in sharp contrast to the attitude of Jesus, is it not? Jesus is not in this deep, deep mourning. He's coming not just to console. He's coming to bring hope. He's coming to bring trust. He's coming to instill a greater trust. So verse 20, Martha therefore, when she heard that Jesus was coming, went to meet him. But Mary still sat in the house. This is just typical of their personalities. Martha's the busy one, remember? She's up and about, doing all the work. She's doing all the, engaged in so many activities. She's the assertive one. She's the one who takes the initiative. Mary is the more passive one. She sits at Jesus' feet. She waits to be asked. Their response to the coming of Jesus just fits their personality. And each one of these personality traits has its strengths and has its weaknesses. There's a time for sitting and waiting, and there's a time for getting up and acting and doing. Here Martha showed the appropriate response. Remember in the previous account in Luke chapter 10, verse 38 through 42, it was Martha that was too busy to pay attention to Jesus. And it was Mary who sat at the feet. Now it's Martha who's giving the appropriate response, and Mary is being a little bit too passive. Martha comes to Jesus. Verse 21, Martha therefore said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you. Now this is not a rebuke. She's not coming to Jesus and saying, Jesus, if you hadn't dilly-dallied back there, and if you'd have gotten here quicker, you'd have been able to keep my brother from dying. But now he's dead, and he's in the tomb, and he's been there 4 days, and he's starting to decompose. This is not a rebuke. There's no expression of disappointment in Jesus. Yes, she's grieved over her brother Lazarus dying. But she is not put out with Jesus. She's not disappointed with Jesus. These are words of grief. They're words of faith. After all, what did Jesus told the messenger when he came with the news that Lazarus was sick? The one whom you love is sick. And what was Jesus' response? Well, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God. So what does this mean? What does this message mean? It must have some other implication, but what? What? You understand the confusion that must be in Martha's mind? Jesus had said, this sickness is not unto death. But he had died, and he's been dead 4 days. But she didn't lay any fault at Jesus' feet. She's not expressing disappointment in Jesus. And notice she says that I know whatever you ask of God, God will give you. She tells him in 21, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. See, she trusts in what Jesus could have done had he been there. She knows what Jesus could have done. She doesn't doubt that he had the ability and the willingness to heal her brother had he been there. But he didn't do it. He could have just spoken the word like he did with the centurion and healed him from a distance, but he didn't do it. But yet he said it's not unto death, but he died. What's going on here? There's no rebuke. Even when Martha says, if you had been here, she's just stating a fact. That if, it's a second class conditional clause, it's contrary to fact clause. If you had been here, but you weren't, then you wouldn't have died. See, her belief, her persuasion that Jesus could and would have healed him had he been there. And what was that persuasion based on? It was based on the fact of she knew who he is, his character, what he was like. She never doubts his character. She never doubts his love for them. She never asks why. How often do people get mad at God when he doesn't answer their requests? How many people say, well, God could have stopped that drunk driver from wrecking my family. God could have stopped that tsunami that hit Japan. God could have stopped that earthquake. God could have stopped that house fire. God could have stopped my loved one from getting cancer. God could have stopped this disease if he had wanted to. See, they're not questioning God's ability, are they? They're affirming that God could have done something. What they're questioning is God's goodness. They're questioning his goodness. They can't reconcile a good and loving God with disaster, with suffering, with tragedy, with evil. And why not? Because they don't know God as he is. They don't know his true nature. They don't know his character. They don't trust in who he is. This was a problem with Israel, wasn't it? Back in Psalm 78, Asaph records in verse 17 through 22, speaking of the nation of Israel, after God had shown all his goodness to him in the wilderness, yet they still continued to sin against him, to rebel against the Most High in the desert, and in their heart they put God to the test by asking food according to their desire. Then they spoke against God. They said, can God prepare a table in the wilderness? Behold, he struck the rock so that waters gushed out and streams were overflowing. Can he give bread also? Will he provide meat for his people? Therefore the Lord heard and was full of wrath. And a fire was kindled against Jacob, and anger also mounted against Israel, because they did not believe in God and did not trust in his salvation. So that was all the reason. They just didn't believe in God. They didn't trust him. Lamentations is a wonderful book. Probably not the best book to read if you're feeling slightly depressed. Lamentations, Jeremiah is just lamenting the destruction of Jerusalem, the destruction of the southern kingdom of Judah. His life is just coming apart. All that Jeremiah loves is just falling apart around them. Everything is being destroyed. Everything is being desecrated. It's being taken off into captivity. Everything is gone. It's just wiped away. But Jeremiah turns this tragedy into a triumph of faith and of trust. Verse 21 of Lamentations chapter 3. This I recall to mind, therefore I have hope. The Lord's loving kindnesses indeed never cease. His compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, therefore I have hope in him. The Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the person who seeks him. It is good that he waits silently for the salvation of the Lord. And he just pours out his heart. He pours out his trust in God. The circumstances don't change who God is. And then he asks this question in verse 39. Why should any living mortal or any man offer complaint in view of his sins? You think you deserve better? You think you don't deserve this? In view of your sins? We don't deserve anything good from God. Jeremiah turns this tragedy into a triumph. God has never failed in the past. He promises to be faithful in the future. And so Jeremiah finds hope. He finds comfort because of the God that he knows and that he loves. He knows God as he is. He knows that God's ways are not our ways, that God's thoughts are not our thoughts. God asks in Job, who became my counselor? God doesn't ask our opinion, despite what the word of faith, name it, and claim it people say. According to them, God can't do anything without man's permission on earth. He trusted in the God that he knew and he loved. And so Martha's faith, her trust, is not shaken by her loss. She's still confident in Jesus because she knows who she trusts. And then she even affirms in verse 22, even now, after Lazarus has died, even now, under these circumstances, even now, when there seems no hope, even now, I know. The word know, Greek word oida, just means to perceive, to realize. And it's in the perfect tense. And the perfect tense indicates an action that happened in the past with the results that continue to the present time. What is that? So big deal. What does that mean? See, Martha came to a true understanding of Jesus in the past. And it is that understanding that informs her response to Jesus in the present under these circumstances. It dictates her attitudes. It dictates her response to Jesus now. The circumstances are not dictating her view of Jesus. Her view of Jesus is dictating her view of the circumstances. This is vital, vital to the Christian life. She's not controlled by the circumstances. She's not controlled by her emotions. She's not controlled by her own desires, but by the knowledge of Jesus Christ, who he is, what his character is. People do not come to this knowledge in times of tragedy. That's not the time people usually come to a true knowledge of God. In times of tragedy, times of suffering, they're acting on the knowledge that they already have. They're acting on what they think God is like, who they think Jesus is, whether that knowledge is true or false. That's what they're going to act on. Or they're just going to have a superficial cry for help. God, help me. Get me out of this mess. Get me out of this situation. know, when 9/11 happens and the churches are full for 2 weeks, and afterwards everybody goes back to living their own sinful life. There's no desire to change, just the desire to be delivered. Or maybe sometimes people are just afraid to blame God, but they have no comfort. They have no comfort in His care. They have no comfort in His nature. They have no comfort in His character. They have no comfort in His love. They see no higher purpose for what has just happened to them. Now Martha says, I know, or I have known from the past, and I still know it now, that whatever you ask of God, God will give you. This little word ask, aiteo, Jesus never uses this word for His own prayer to God, because this word implies more the request of an inferior to a superior. The word that Jesus uses for His prayers to God is always the one equal asking another equal for something. So Martha's not quite fully understanding the relationship of the Son and the Father here, but still she trusts. She's still trusting. There's a mix of hope. There's a mix of grief. She's still remembering what the messenger said. But see, the main point here, the thing that's important, is that Martha's confidence, her trust in Jesus, is unwavering. Just because Jesus did not do as she hoped does not shake her trust. John said, well, that didn't help. I prayed, but God didn't do anything. What use is this? What use is this faith? We trusted. We did all this that God told us to do, and nothing happened. See, Jesus' decision not to intervene doesn't produce anger on Martha's part. It doesn't produce resentment. It didn't produce disillusionment. Rather, she acknowledges Jesus' special relationship with God. Whatever you ask, even now, He'll give it to you. You have access to divine power. That's unquestioned. His character, His love is unchallenged. Whatever you ask, He'll do it. So Jesus consoles her. Jesus said to her, your brother shall rise again. Well, this is kind of ambiguous. I mean, this was just a common platitude that mourners who didn't know what else to say would tell people. They heard it probably already 50 times or more since Lazarus has died. Jesus here is affirming the certainty of the resurrection, of course, which was denied by the Sadducees, wasn't it? But Jesus is just, He's stating more than a theological point here. He's giving a promise. Your brother shall rise again. Now. Now. Not in the future. Now. She doesn't quite understand this. He's going to make it clear to her. But this is a promise. And it's a personal promise. It's not just abstract theological fact. Jesus' promises are personal for us. They're not abstract theological facts. We live on those promises. They are for us. Well, Martha just understood this as cold theological fact. I know that He will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. This is just cold, impersonal, abstract theological truth. It's just a truth she took for granted. See, there's no personal, immediate application to her life for this. She doesn't understand it as a personal promise. But Jesus here is wanting to take her beyond the abstract to a real, personal, experiential faith. An experiential faith. Not experiences, mystical experiences, but experiential faith. Living what she says she believes. A personal faith. And so He tells her, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me shall live even if he dies, and everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Now this is the fifth of seven I am statements in the Gospel of John. See, Jesus is making it personal. He is the resurrection and the life. He doesn't just raise the dead and give life. He is the resurrection and the life. He's not just the one who bestows it. He is it. He's the resurrection and the life in person. The resurrection and the life is Jesus. Apart from Him, there's only death. And this is what Martha failed to grasp. No resurrection and no life apart from Jesus. Now, in this statement of Jesus, there's just some beautiful parallelism here. He explains, I'm the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me shall live even if he dies. I'm the resurrection. How is he the resurrection? Well, whoever believes, present tense, abidingly, continuously, habitually, is the character of their life. Whoever believes shall live even if he dies. He will come to life. That's how he's the resurrection. When you're a believer in him, not just intellectual acknowledgement of certain facts, but believe abidingly, constantly, you shall live. You will come to life. That's what Job affirmed, right? Job 19:25-27, that even though my bones decay, my flesh falls off, I will see him in my flesh. And John, over in 1 John, toward the end of his first epistle, 1 John chapter 5, verse 20, or I'm sorry, not 1 John, John 5:21. This whole statement here, behind the resurrection and the life, is being based on the statement that Jesus had said earlier, over in chapter 5. For just as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, even so the Son also gives life to whom He wishes. And that's what He's basing this on. He's going to come to life. And then He says, I'm the life, I'm the resurrection, because whoever believes in me shall live, even if he dies, he's going to come back to life. And He's the life. How is He the life? Well, that's what verse 26 says. Everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. See, everyone who lives, Zoe, spiritual life, he's not saying that everyone who is alive and breathing, but everyone who has spiritual life, saving life, regenerated life, a new life, and believes abidingly in me shall never die. And that word never is oume, the strongest negation in the Greek. Never, ever, ever, under any circumstances, ever, will they die? Whoever lives, see, that's internal, the new birth, and believes, that's the manifestation of the new life. Obedience, trust, following Him, just as He had said over in chapter 8, verse 51, truly, truly, I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he shall never see death. That's what it means to believe, is to keep His word. Follow Him wherever He goes. Just like the disciples, remember? Jesus, you want to go back there? They were trying to kill you. Sometimes following Jesus will take us where we don't want to go. Places where we would never choose to go. Now our mortal life will end, but Jesus is life. And the life that He gives never ends. Now unbelievers reject both of this. They reject the resurrection, they reject the life, they rely on their own righteousness, they hope heaven and hell is not a reality. They think God is just going to admit anybody and everybody. He's so good. He's so gracious. He's so loving. He would never send anybody to hell. That's not what Jesus said. Life is only for those who believe. Acts 4:12. There is only one name given among men under heaven by which we must be saved. Jesus Christ, right? Now we can go to 1 John. 1 John Chapter 5, verses 10 through 12. The one who believes in the Son of God has the witness in himself. The one who does not believe God has made him a liar, because he has not believed in the witness that God has borne concerning his Son. And the witness is this, that God has given us eternal life, and this life is in His Son. He who has the Son has the life. He who does not have the Son of God does not have the life. See, Allah doesn't give life. Buddha doesn't give life. Vishnu doesn't give life. Shiva doesn't give life. Pope doesn't give life. Saints don't give life. Jesus of your own imagination does not give life. It is the Jesus of the Bible that gives life. And he asked, Jesus asked her, do you, Martha, believe this? Believe what? Not if Jesus will raise brother on the last day. Yeah, she's already said, I know he'll rise again on the last day. That's not what he's asking. He's not asking her, do you believe in the doctrine of the resurrection? No. Martha, can your faith go beyond the abstract theology? Can your faith go to a personal trust in Jesus as the resurrection and the life? Do you personally trust Him for everything? In this life and the next, do you live what you believe unconditionally? Well, Martha's response, yes, Lord. Yes, Lord, you are the resurrection and the life. That's what yes, Lord is referring to. But then she adds to it. She builds on that. I have believed, again, perfect tense. I have believed. Believed it in the past. And I still believe it now. I have believed. She believed three things. You are the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God, even He who comes into the world. What was the purpose of John's Gospel? Remember John chapter 20, verse 31 and 32? These things I have written to you so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and in believing you may have eternal life. Martha got it. She got it. I have believed. She is confessing Jesus' full deity. Just that little pronoun, I. It's emphatic. Yes, Lord, I have believed. Others haven't. Others have rejected. Others have blasphemed. Others have tried to stone you. Others have dishonored you. Others have said you had a demon. Others were too afraid to confess you before men for fear of the Jews. But I have believed. I have believed. And back to 1 John chapter 5, verse 20. And we know that the Son of God has come and has given us understanding in order that we might know Him who is true. And we are in Him who is true, in His Son, Jesus Christ. This is the true God and eternal life. See, See, it doesn't matter what God you believe in if you don't believe in the true God. It doesn't matter what Jesus you believe in if you don't believe in the true Jesus. This is why Martha's trust is unshaken. She knows who Jesus is. I have believed. She believes in the right Jesus. So she goes, after this confession, she goes and gets Mary. When she had said this, she went away, called Mary her sister, saying secretly. Why secretly? Well, to protect Jesus? Possibly, but Jesus doesn't seem to be too concerned for his own safety. More than likely, just to try to preserve some privacy. Not create an uproar. Saying, the teacher is here and is calling for you. And when she heard it, she arose quickly and was coming to him. This is how we need to go to Jesus. Quickly. Trusting. Confident. Submissive. Now, how do you respond to the trials that come our way, that come your way? Question? Get angry? Do you pray for a while and say, oh, that didn't work? The outcome wasn't as I'd hoped, it wasn't as I expected. Do you get disappointed in God? Is your faith just abstract? Do you believe in just some theological facts but don't live it? If you don't live it, you don't believe it. Do you think your circumstances are an expression of God's love or an expression of His neglect and indifference? Do you question His goodness? Go quickly to Jesus. Fall at His feet. Embrace Him as the way, the truth, the life, the resurrection and the life. That's our only hope.